Welcome to Lindy Upgrade Studio. Our TOEFL reading podcast helps you build the background knowledge, academic vocabulary, and useful expressions behind real TOEFL reading passages. So whether you're out for a run, at the gym, on your commute, or doing chores around the house, pop in your earbuds and let English sink in naturally.
And we are so excited you're joining us today for this deep dive because, well, we have a truly fascinating topic to unpack.
We really do. I mean, just think about this for a second. What actually happens when a creature with a brain, roughly the size of a grain of sand, passes a complex psychological test?
A test that was literally designed for a human toddler, by the way.
Right, exactly. Because we usually think of humans as, you know, the undisputed champions of intelligence, right? With maybe a few close runners up like, I don't know, chimpanzees or dolphins.
Yeah, our closest evolutionary cousins.
But then when a tiny tropical reef fish completely shatters the boundaries of what science thought was possible, it kind of forces us to ask a really uncomfortable question.
Yeah.
Do we actually understand how the mind works at all?
It really throws a wrench in the whole system.
It does. So welcome to today's deep dive. We are unpacking a really famous TOEFL reading passage known as the Mirror Test. And our mission today, as always, is to break down the dense cognitive science in this text, extract the high-level C1 academic vocabulary you'll need for test day, and really explore the root words to make these concepts stick.
Because, and I always tell students this, understanding the architecture of the ideas is really the secret to high-level reading comprehension.
It's not just rote memorization.
Exactly, no. It's never just about memorizing a list of vocabulary words in a vacuum. If you understand the scientific context, if you can, you know, visualize the experiments and grasp the logic the author is using to build their argument, the vocabulary naturally falls into place. You start to anticipate the words before you even read them.
That makes total sense.
Right. And the passage we're analyzing today is just a perfect example of this. It takes us on this wild journey from human developmental psychology to primate biology, and then finally all the way to marine ecosystems, challenging our basic assumptions about self-awareness along the way.
So let's jump right into the text. Now, the author doesn't actually start with animals at all, which is interesting. They start by establishing a baseline using human beings.
Which is a classic academic writing strategy, by the way. Start with what we know.
Yeah, exactly. So the opening paragraph states that very young children actually cannot recognize themselves in a mirror. According to the text, a human toddler usually only achieves this realization around 18 months of age.
And that is a crucial starting point. Because before we can measure how animals perceive themselves, we have to understand how our own species develops that perception. Like when a human baby is born, they possess absolutely no concept of a separate self.
Right, it's just all input.
Exactly. If you place a six-month-old infant in front of a mirror, you'll see them smile, wave, babble, maybe even try to reach out and kiss the glass. But they aren't admiring themselves. As far as their developing brain is concerned, they're looking at a completely different baby.
Oh, wow. So they think it's just a playmate.
Yeah. They think they've just met a very friendly, highly responsive new friend.
I always like to think about it like a video game. I mean, imagine you are playing a game. For the first year and a half of that baby's life, they are essentially an NPC.
A non-player character. I love that analogy.
Right. The hardware of the body is running perfectly. The sensory inputs are functioning. The eyes are taking in light. The stomach is signaling hunger. You know, the lungs are breathing. The baby reacts to its environment based entirely on biological programming. But the player, that conscious identity operating system that says, hey, I'm the one holding the controller. I'm a unique entity that hasn't logged in yet.
It's still booting up.
Exactly. It takes about 18 months for that psychological software to fully install. And when it finally boots up, the child looks in the mirror, and the illusion of the other baby just shatters. They realize, ah, that's me.
And that transition from NPC to active player is exactly what cognitive scientists call self-awareness. It's one of the most heavily studied phenomena in psychology. And to understand the mechanics of what's happening in that 18-month-old brain, we have to look at how the brain maps information.
Okay, break that down for us.
Sure. So the child is receiving visual input from the mirror. They see a hand moving, but simultaneously they are receiving proprioceptive input.
Proprioceptive, that's a big one.
Yeah, proprioception is basically your body's internal sense of where its parts are in space. Like even if you close your eyes right now, you know exactly where your arm is.
Right. I don't need to look at my hand to know it's resting on the desk.
Precisely. So the toddler's brain suddenly connects these two distinct streams of data. It calculates, wait, I feel my arm moving up, and I see the arm in the glass moving up at the exact same millisecond. Therefore, the image in the glass is not an independent entity. The image is a visual extension of my physical self.
That is so cool to think about. And the text highlights this exact moment of realization, calling it a major milestone. It states that children achieve this milestone around 18 months. Now, milestone is a fantastic piece of academic vocabulary. It's a solid C1 level word that shows up constantly in university lectures and TOEFL texts.
Oh, absolutely. And the etymology, the history of the word, is incredibly visual, which makes it easy to remember.
Let's unpack that.
Well, it's one of those words that paints a perfect picture of its own meaning. Milestone is a compound word combining mile, which is a unit of distance, and stone, like a rock. To really grasp it, we need to travel back about 2,000 years to the ancient Roman Empire.
Okay, history lesson, let's go.
So the Romans were famous for engineering this massive, intricate network of roads stretching across Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East, like the famous Appian Way. But if you're a Roman soldier marching for days or, you know, merchant transporting goods, you need to know exactly where you are and how far you have left to go. So the engineers placed large cylindrical stone pillars on the side of the road at intervals of exactly one Roman mile.
So these were literal physical objects. Like you're walking down a dusty road, your feet are tired, and you look ahead and see this giant rock carved with numbers. It tells you that you've successfully traveled another mile. It's a physical marker of your progress on a long, arduous journey.
Exactly that. The stone marked the completion of a specific stage of travel. Now, obviously, we don't use the word to talk about rocks on the side of the highway anymore.
Right. Mostly, we just have green metal signs now.
Right. In modern academic English, the word has become entirely metaphorical. A milestone is a significant event, a major breakthrough, or a crucial turning point in the development of a project, a person's life, or a scientific field. It marks major, undeniable progress.
And if you're tackling the TOEFL speaking or writing sections, you want to make sure you're pairing this noun with the right verbs. We call these collocations. You don't do a milestone or make a milestone. The most natural collocations are achieve a milestone, reach a milestone, or mark a milestone.
Let's think about how a student might use this in an independent writing task. If the prompt asks about the importance of higher education, you wouldn't just say, graduating from university is a good thing. That's way too basic.
Yeah, you want to elevate that.
Right. You would elevate your language and write, graduating from university represents a critical milestone in a young adult's professional development. It instantly sounds more authoritative.
Or thinking about language learning itself. When you, the listener, transition from translating every single sentence in your head to finally thinking purely in English, that is a massive linguistic milestone. It shows you've traveled a long way down the road of fluency.
That's a perfect example.
So going back to the text, a baby passing the mirror test is a developmental milestone because it proves their cognitive software has reached a new stage. And the passage goes on to say that this self-recognition is a key component of consciousness.
Consciousness. Man, this is perhaps one of the heaviest, most intensely debated words in the English language, firmly rooted in C1 academic territory. Philosophers, neuroscientists, and biologists have spent centuries trying to define it.
It's a big one. Where does it come from?
The word itself comes to us from Latin. It's built with the prefix con, meaning with or together. We see this prefix everywhere, connect, meaning to link together, construct, meaning to build together. The second half of the word comes from the Latin verb sire, which means to know. And by the way, sire is the exact same root that gives us the word science.
Wow. Okay. So if you fuse con and sire together, the literal ancient meaning is to know together or to possess shared knowledge.
Exactly. But over centuries, that meaning evolved inward. It shifted from sharing knowledge with others to having an internal shared knowledge with yourself. Today, consciousness refers to the state of being awake, aware of your surroundings, and most importantly, aware of your own inner existence. It's the internal monologue running in your head right now. It's the feeling of experiencing the world subjectively.
And for students learning English, I feel like this word introduces a very common, very dangerous vocabulary trap.
Oh, the conscious versus conscience trap.
Yes. It is incredibly easy to confuse the noun consciousness with the adjective conscious, or even worse, with the entirely different noun conscience. Understanding the boundaries between these related words is critical for accurate reading comprehension.
Let's break that down because it is tricky. If you are conscious, ending with an O-U-S, it just means you are physically awake. If a patient is brought into an emergency room after a car accident, a doctor's first question is the patient conscious? Meaning, are their eyes open? Are they responsive? The opposite would be unconscious, meaning knocked out or comatose.
Okay, so that makes sense. Conscious is a medical or physical state. But what about the other trap? Because I see students mix up consciousness, meaning self-awareness, with the word conscience all the time. They sound remarkably similar. They share the same Latin roots, but they govern completely different parts of the human experience.
Yeah, let's separate them completely. Consciousness, the word from our reading passage, is cognitive awareness. It's the fact that the lights are on in your brain and you know you exist. Conscience, spelled C-O-N-S-C-I-E-N-C-E, is your moral compass. It is the psychological mechanism that dictates your sense of right and wrong, guilt and virtue.
Let's put this into a real-world scenario to make it bulletproof for the listener. Imagine you're walking down an empty street, and you see a wallet sitting on a park bench. You pick it up, and it's stuffed with $1,000 in cash. Your consciousness is the part of your brain processing the physical reality. I am a person holding a leather object. The object contains paper money. I am standing in a park. It's just the awareness of the situation.
Right. But your conscience is the little voice that immediately chimes in afterward. It's the ethical debate. Your conscience says, well, nobody is looking. You could keep the money. But wait, someone lost this. They might need it for rent. You would feel terrible if you lost your wallet. You should probably take it to the police station.
Exactly. Consciousness tells you that you exist. Conscience tells you how to behave. And in the context of the mirror test passage, morality isn't a factor. The text is strictly discussing consciousness. The toddler isn't having a moral debate with the mirror.
Right. They aren't worried about whether the mirror is good or evil.
No. The toddler is simply establishing the baseline awareness of, hey, I am a physical entity occupying space.
And establishing that baseline serves a very specific structural purpose in the author's argument. In academic writing, authors often build a foundation of something familiar, like human development, before introducing the unknown. Once the text locks in the definition of consciousness and proves that humans achieve it at 18 months, it creates a logical pivot point. The author uses this human baseline to launch into the central question of the passage. If humans possess this intricate identity software, are we the only ones? Or does this operating system exist elsewhere in the animal kingdom?
And this is where the passage leaves the nursery and heads into the jungle. We transition from human psychology to primate biology. The text points out that for decades, scientists have known that members of the great ape family, chimpanzees, orangutans, gorillas, are capable of recognizing themselves in mirrors.
And the methodology scientists use to prove this is brilliant in its simplicity. It's incredibly rigorous. It's known formally as the Gordon-Gallup mirror test, named after the psychologist who pioneered it in the 1970s. The passage summarizes the test briefly, but the mechanics of how it's conducted are vital for understanding the results. You don't just hand a mirror to a chimpanzee and ask what it thinks.
Right, because if you just put a mirror in a chimp's cage, they might look at it. But how do you scientifically prove what's happening inside their head? You need measurable, observable data.
Exactly. So researchers established a very specific protocol. First, they allow the ape to become familiar with a mirror for a few days, letting the initial novelty wear off. Then they temporarily sedate the ape, put it to sleep so it has no conscious memory of what happens next. While the animal is asleep, the researchers apply an odorless, non-irritating colored dye, usually a bright red mark, to a part of the ape's body that it cannot see without the aid of a mirror. They usually choose the center of the forehead or the top of an ear.
Crucially, the dye doesn't smell like anything, and it doesn't itch or sting, so the ape can't feel that it's there.
That's the control factor. If the dye itched, the ape would just scratch its forehead naturally, ruining the experiment. The ape wakes up, goes about its normal business, feeling completely fine. Then researchers introduce the mirror back into the enclosure, and the passage notes the critical observation. When the ape looks into the mirror and sees the reflection of the red mark, it immediately reaches up and tries to remove the mark from its own body.
Okay, wait, hold on. Let me put on my skeptical reader hat here.
Go for it.
If I take my pet cat and I somehow manage to put a red sticker on her forehead and then put her in front of a mirror, she's going to react. She'll see the red dot in the glass, and she'll likely bat at the mirror with her paws. She might even try to scratch the glass to catch the dot. How do researchers know that chimpanzee isn't just treating the mirror like a toy or trying to wipe a smudge off what it thinks is a window?
That's the exact kind of critical questioning you need to apply when reading scientific texts. The author anticipates that exact objection, which is why the phrasing in the passage is so deliberate. The text explicitly states that the ape tried to remove the mark on its own body. It doesn't reach out to the glass, doesn't try to groom the other ape in the mirror. It looks at the reflection, brings its own hand up to its own physical forehead, and touches the die.
Ah, that's the key difference. The cat touches the mirror, the ape touches itself.
Yes, and from a neurological standpoint, touching its own face proves a staggering level of cognitive processing. Think back to our discussion of human toddlers. The ape is seamlessly integrating visual data with proprioceptive data. It calculates, the ape in the glass has a mark. The ape in the glass moves its arm exactly when I move my arm. Therefore, the visual representation in the glass is a direct map of my physical form. Therefore, that mark is on my skin. The physical act of touching the self is the undeniable proof of self-recognition.
The ape is essentially looking at the mirror and saying, that's me, and I look ridiculous with this red paint on my head. Let me wipe that off. And that perfectly introduces our next vocabulary deep dive, the word reflection. This is a word that straddles the line between B2 and C1, depending on how an author deploys it.
Right, let's look at the Latin roots, which provide a great visual anchor. Reflection is composed of two parts. The prefix is re, which means back, or again, we use it constantly, return to turn back, rebuild to build again, rebound to bounce back. The second part is the root flector, which is Latin for to bend. You can hear the echo of flector in English words like flexible, meaning capable of bending, or deflect, meaning to bend something away from its path.
So if we translate the root parts literally, a reflection is simply the act of bending back.
Exactly. In the realm of physics and optics, a reflection is quite literal. Light particles, or photons, travel through the air, hit the smooth, dense surface of a mirror, and bend back toward your eyes. The ape sees the light bending back off the glass, creating its image. But in a C1 academic context, reflection frequently takes on a deeper metaphorical meaning. It moves from physics into psychology.
Right. When a university professor asks you to write a reflective essay at the end of a semester, they aren't asking you to write about mirrors. If I say, upon reflection, I realized that moving to a new city was the best decision I ever made, the mechanics of the word are the same, but the application is entirely internal.
You're still bending something back, but instead of light, you're bending your thoughts. You are turning your cognitive focus backward in time, looking deeply into your own mind, your own memories, and your own past decisions. Mental reflection requires the ability to examine your own internal state. So the word carries a beautiful dual meaning in English, the physical bouncing of light and the internal examination of the self.
The passage states that possessing the ability to process this reflection is a key component of self-awareness. Let's pause and isolate that word, component, because this is an excellent piece of academic vocabulary that you should actively integrate into your active vocabulary.
Definitely. Component is a structural word. It's how we talk about the architecture of systems.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at its Latin origins, it begins with the prefix com, which, as we established earlier with consciousness, means together. The root is ponere, which translates to put or to place. Therefore, a component is literally something that is put together with other things.
You know, I constantly hear students default to the word part. They might write grammar is an important part of the TOEFL exam. And there's nothing grammatically incorrect about that. Part is a perfectly fine A1 or A2 level word. But if you want to demonstrate a wider lexical resource, if you want to sound more sophisticated and academic, you upgrade part to component.
The distinction is subtle but really important. A part can just be a random piece. A component implies that the piece has a specific necessary function within a larger integrated system. Think of a jet engine. It isn't just a pile of parts, it's a highly engineered system made of thousands of vital components, turbines, compressors, fuel injectors. If you remove one component, the entire system fails.
Right, like a university curriculum has many components, lectures, seminars, lab work, exams. In the context of our reading passage, the ability to recognize a reflection isn't just a random trick the brain can do. It is a key component. It is a vital functional piece of machinery that, when combined with memory, emotion, and sensory input, builds the overall engine of self-awareness.
And you want to practice the collocations that signal academic fluency. You rarely just say a component. You describe its importance, a key component, a crucial component, an essential component, or a fundamental component. If you're analyzing a reading passage about economics, you might note that consumer confidence is a fundamental component of a stable market. It adds immediate weight to your sentence.
Let's carry that logic forward into the next section of the passage. So the author has established the rule for humans and then applied it to great apes. From an evolutionary perspective, humans and chimpanzees are incredibly close relatives. We share roughly 98% of our DNA. We have similar brain structures, forward-facing eyes, grasping hands. So while it's fascinating that apes have this cognitive component, it doesn't completely rewrite the rules of biology. It makes sense that our closest evolutionary cousins share similar operating systems.
But the author doesn't stop with primates. The passage executes a massive conceptual leap here. It introduces two entirely different branches of the animal family tree, elephants and dolphins. We are leaving the realm of primates entirely and venturing into the savanna and the deep ocean.
Right. The text groups them together, stating, "Elephants and dolphins have shown signs of self-recognition. These, like apes, are highly intelligent animals."
And the phrase "highly intelligent" isn't just thrown in casually. In the field of cognitive biology, intelligence isn't measured the way we measure human IQ. I mean, you can't hand a dolphin a math test.
That would be a very soggy test.
Exactly. Instead, scientists look for a constellation of specific traits that indicate a high-functioning cognitive system. Apes, elephants, and dolphins share several critical biological and behavioral markers.
First and foremost is brain physiology, right? We're talking about massive, dense, highly folded brains. The encephalization quotient, which is just a fancy way of comparing brain size to body mass, is extremely high in all three groups.
Yes. But beyond pure hardware, scientists look at behavioral complexity, specifically complex social structures. None of these animals are solitary wanderers. Chimpanzees live in highly political troops. Elephants live in tight-knit matriarchal herds where knowledge is passed down through generations. Dolphins live in intricate pods with shifting alliances. They possess highly developed communication systems. Dolphins even use unique signature whistles, which are essentially names they use to identify themselves and call specific individuals.
Wow, they literally have names for each other. And they also exhibit long-term memory and problem-solving skills. They remember past events, recognize individuals they haven't seen in years, and can strategize. And perhaps the most advanced indicator of intelligence is tool use. We know chimps use sticks to fish for termites, but elephants are also tool users. They'll use branches to swat away flies or scratch areas they can't reach.
And dolphins, despite lacking hands, are incredible tool users. In Shark Bay, Australia, certain pods of dolphins have been observed tearing off pieces of sea sponges and wearing them over their snouts like a glove. This protects their sensitive noses from sharp rocks and stingrays while they forage in the ocean floor. So when the author categorizes them as highly intelligent, it's based on decades of rigorous behavioral evidence.
Okay, but how on earth do you administer the mirror test to a dolphin or an elephant? An ape has hands. It can touch its forehead. How does a dolphin prove it recognizes a mark?
Yeah, the methodology has to be completely adapted to the animal's physical form. For dolphins, researchers like Diana Race and Lori Marino designed massive, durable mirrors and submerged them in the pool walls. They used a process called sham marking, where they would pretend to mark the dolphin with a water-filled marker just so the dolphin felt the physical touch to ensure the dolphin wasn't just reacting to the feeling of being touched. Then they applied real, visible black ink.
And what do the dolphins do? I mean, they can't point.
The reaction was undeniable. The dolphins didn't try to fight the reflection or play with it like another dolphin. They swam directly to the mirror and began contorting their bodies. They would twist, swim upside down, and posture themselves repeatedly to expose the marked area of their skin to the mirror. They would blow bubbles at the glass while watching the reflection to see how the bubbles moved. They were actively investigating their own bodies using the reflective surface.
That is wild. And the elephant test is just as crazy. Researchers built a massive shatterproof mirror at the Bronx Zoo. They placed a visible white X on the forehead of an Asian elephant named Happy. Happy didn't touch the mirror. She walked up to it, looked at the reflection, and repeatedly brought her trunk up to touch the exact spot on her own head where the X was painted. It's the exact same mechanism as the ape, just using a trunk instead of a hand.
Which brings us to an incredibly nuanced vocabulary distinction that the text navigates, the difference between self-recognition and self-awareness. Throughout the passage, these terms orbit each other, and a high-level reader needs to understand why the author chooses one over the other in different sentences.
They definitely aren't interchangeable synonyms. Let's untangle them for the listeners.
Think of self-recognition as the physical, observable action. It is the empirical data. It is the behavioral output that a scientist can record on camera. When the elephant touches the white X with its trunk, or when the dolphin twists its body to show the marked side, that physical maneuver is recognition. The animal has successfully passed the mechanical test.
But self-awareness is the invisible internal state. It's the psychological condition operating inside the brain. We cannot look inside an elephant's mind and see awareness. We can only infer that the awareness exists because we witnessed the physical act of recognition.
A helpful analogy for this is the relationship between a symptom and a disease in medicine. If a patient comes in coughing constantly, the cough is the physical, verifiable symptom. Anyone in the room can hear it and record it. But the viral infection in their lungs is the underlying condition causing the cough. You can't see the virus without a microscope, but the cough proves it's there.
That's a great way to think about it.
Yeah, so in our text, the mirror test, the self-recognition, is the visible symptom. The underlying cognitive condition is self-awareness. When an author switches between the two words, they are carefully distinguishing between the experiment's results and the experiment's meaning.
That is a phenomenal breakdown. So let's look at where the argument stands structurally at this point in the passage. The author has built a very neat logical pattern, a biological rule. Humans have self-awareness. Apes have it. Elephants have it. Dolphins have it. The established rule in the scientific community seems clear. To possess the identity operating system of self-awareness, you must have an extraordinarily large, complex brain, and you must be a highly intelligent social mammal. The science feels settled.
Right. For a very long time, that was the unquestioned consensus. The paradigm was completely solid.
And then the author throws an absolute wrecking ball into the text, a massive narrative plot twist. The text reads, "But in a more recent experiment, a type of fish called the cleaner fish tried to scrape a mark off its body when it saw itself in the mirror." I remember reading this for the first time and just stopping in my tracks. A fish.
And not just any fish, a blue streak cleaner wrasse. It's a tiny fish, about the size of a human finger, that lives on coral reefs.
This completely breaks the established biological rule. I mean, we usually think of fish as biological automatons. We think of them as having practically zero memory, driven entirely by instinct, eat, swim, hide from predators. To return to our technology analogy, if the human brain is the latest, most powerful quantum computer, and an ape or dolphin brain is a high-end gaming laptop, a fish's brain is like a cheap solar-powered pocket calculator from 1985. The hardware is incredibly basic. It shouldn't have the processing power to run the complex identity software required for self-awareness.
It's true that the cleaner fish's brain is microscopic compared to a primate. It lacks the massive cerebral cortex where we assume high-level processing takes place. However, the cleaner wrasse occupies a highly specific ecological niche. Its entire existence is based on cleaning parasites off the scales of much larger fish. It has evolved to be intensely visually observant, scanning surfaces for tiny imperfections and marks.
So researchers, led by a team in Japan, decided to test if this extreme visual attention applied to the fish's own body. They injected a tiny amount of brown elastomer gel just under the skin of the fish's throat, an area it couldn't see directly. And then they introduced a mirror into the tank.
And the fish's behavior mirrored the great apes, but adapted for its own anatomy. First, the fish postured in front of the mirror, swimming upside down and rapidly darting back and forth, clearly testing the contingency of the reflection checking if the image moved exactly when it moved. Once it locked onto the fact that the reflection was itself, it noticed the brown mark on its throat.
And this is where the author's vocabulary choice is brilliant. The text says the fish tried to scrape the mark off. This is our sixth vocabulary deep dive. Why use the word scrape? In the ape section, the author used the word remove. Why change verbs?
Well, an ape has highly articulated fingers with opposable thumbs. It can gently, precisely pick or brush a mark off its skin. A fish lacks any grasping appendages. It doesn't have hands, paws, or a trunk. To remove something stuck to its body, it has to use the environment. The word scrape implies significant physical friction and force against a hard, rough surface.
To scrape something means you are grinding it, rubbing it aggressively against something abrasive to tear off the top layer. So the fish, seeing the mark in the mirror, swam rapidly down to the bottom of the tank, turned sideways, and forcefully rubbed its throat against the sharp sand and coral substrate, trying to physically scratch the mark away. Then it would swim back up to the mirror to check if the mark was gone. It's an incredibly deliberate, forceful action.
It really is. And we use the verb scrape constantly in everyday English. And it almost always involves friction and a hard tool or surface. Like, if you live in a snowy climate on a freezing morning, you can't just brush the ice off your car windshield. You have to take a plastic tool and forcefully scrape off the layer of ice.
Or if you're hiking on a muddy trail and your boots get caked in thick, wet dirt. Before you go inside a house, you find the sharp edge of a stone step and aggressively drag the bottom of your shoe against it to scrape off the mud.
Or a child running on a concrete playground who trips and falls. They might scrape their knee, meaning the friction of the rough concrete violently tore away the top layer of skin. By choosing the word scrape, the author paints a vivid, dynamic picture of the fish's behavior. The fish isn't just passively looking at the mark, it's aggressively trying to eradicate it.
And this aggressively scraping fish leads to the final, earth-shattering conclusion of the reading passage. The text states, "This suggests that even less intelligent animals may possess more self-awareness than previously suspected." That final phrase, "previously suspected," is a goldmine of C1 academic phrasing, and it represents a massive concept in how science works.
Let's isolate the word suspect for a minute. In conversational English, or when watching a crime movie, suspect has a very specific negative connotation. A detective points at someone and says, "He is the prime suspect in the bank robbery." Or you might say, "I am highly suspicious of that salesman," meaning you don't trust him.
Right. The everyday meaning implies criminality or deceit. But in an academic reading passage about biology or physics, the word operates entirely differently.
Completely differently. In academia, to suspect something simply means to hypothesize. It means to hold a working belief that something is likely true based on the current available evidence, even if you don't have absolute mathematically perfect proof yet. For decades, the scientific community suspected that self-awareness was biologically restricted to animals with massive, complex brains. That was their working model of reality.
So when the author writes, "previously suspected," they're pointing to an old, outdated model. They're saying, hey, this is what the textbooks used to say before this tiny fish came along and ruined everything.
Exactly. In the philosophy of science, there is a famous concept introduced by Thomas Kuhn called a paradigm shift. A paradigm is the accepted set of rules that everyone in a scientific field agrees on. In this case, the paradigm was big brain equals self-awareness, small brain equals biological robot. But science isn't static. When new, undeniable evidence arrives that completely contradicts the old rules, like a cleaner fish passing a mirror test, the old rules break. The paradigm shifts. The textbooks literally have to be rewritten. The phrase "previously suspected" is the linguistic marker of a paradigm shift. It acknowledges the old belief while pivoting to the new reality.
This is such a powerful, elegant phrase for English learners to adopt, especially for the TOEFL writing section. You're often asked to contrast different viewpoints or discuss the impact of new information. Using "previously suspected" makes your writing instantly sound objective, measured, and academic.
It's the perfect tool for demonstrating intellectual evolution. For example, if you're writing an essay on remote work trends, you could write, "Recent data indicates that employees working from home maintain much higher productivity levels than corporate management had previously suspected." You're elegantly stating that the old assumption was wrong without sounding aggressive or informal.
Or in a historical essay, "The discovery of the new ruins revealed that the ancient civilization was far more technologically advanced than archaeologists had previously suspected." It's just a beautiful, high-functioning phrase.
It really elevates the whole sentence.
It does. Well, we have covered a massive amount of intellectual territory today. We've traced the timeline of human cognitive development, analyzed the ingenious methodology of primate testing, marveled at the intelligence of marine mammals, and had our fundamental assumptions challenged by a tiny reef fish. To make sure all this high-level vocabulary and conceptual framework solidifies in your memory, let's take a quick moment to review.
Good idea. The best way to review vocabulary is to see it functioning within the structural flow of the author's argument. A good academic text is engineered with purpose.
Let's retrace the author's steps. The passage begins by laying down the foundation, the baseline of human development. We learn that the ability for a toddler to recognize its own reflection isn't immediate. It's a critical milestone, a major turning point marking developmental progress, a word that evolved from the physical stone markers of ancient Roman roads.
And that milestone proves the existence of consciousness, the state of being awake and possessing an internal awareness of your own existence. A word built from the Latin roots for shared knowledge and critically distinct from the word conscience, which dictates your moral compass.
The author then broadens the scope, applying the Gordon Gallup mirror test to great apes. We saw how the apes demonstrated self-awareness by using their reflection, literally the bending back of light, but metaphorically the ability to look backward into the self to locate and remove a hidden mark.
The author emphasizes that this physical act of self-recognition is a key component, an essential functional piece put together with others to form a larger system of the complex cognitive engine that is self-awareness.
The argument then expands to include the highly intelligent, large-brained outliers of the animal kingdom, the dolphins and elephants, solidifying the assumed biological rules. But finally, the author delivers the paradigm shift. A tiny cleaner wrasse shatters the rules, swimming to the bottom of the tank to aggressively scrape off, using heavy physical friction against a rough surface, a mark from its throat.
This incredible anomaly forces the scientific community to accept that the capacity for an internal identity might be far more widespread across the animal kingdom than they had previously suspected, a phrase that perfectly captures the necessary death of an old assumption in the face of revolutionary new evidence.
If you can confidently navigate those words, if you understand the etymology behind them, and if you grasp the profound distinction between the physical act of recognition and the internal state of awareness, you are more than ready to conquer any TOEFL passage that touches on cognitive science.
But you know, the true value of reading passages like this goes far beyond a standardized test score. These texts are windows into the astonishing complexity of the world around us. And I want to leave you with a philosophical provocation to think about long after this deep dive is over.
I love these. Give us the final thought.
The entire scientific community built its definition of consciousness around the human brain. We assumed that to be self-aware, you needed billions of neurons, a massive cerebral cortex, and complex social structures. But if a cleaner wrasse of fish with a brain so small it barely registers, a creature operating on a completely different evolutionary branch has a genuine sense of self, it changes everything. If that tiny fish can look at a reflection and realize, "That is me, I am an individual existing in the universe," we have to ask, who else is looking back? What other creatures, insects, or birds are navigating their environments right now with a rich, complex inner monologue? Are we, in our human arrogance, completely underestimating the profound inner lives of the entire natural world?
That is a staggering thought. It fundamentally changes how you look at the bird perched on your fence or the dog sleeping on your floor. Are they just reacting to stimuli, or are they experiencing the world as a conscious self? It's a question that science will be wrestling with for the next century. Thank you so much for joining us on this intellectual journey today. Keep questioning the texts you read. Keep digging into the ruse of the language, and keep pushing your comprehension to the absolute limit. You've got this. This episode was created by Lindy Upgrade Studio. Until next time, keep upgrading your English.